Chitale, Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nirvasesa Sunyavadi Paskatyavi Sakarane Mandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Dutam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Dutamscha Vanchakalpa Chirugyascha Kripa Sindhu Diye Bacha Patitanam Pavana Ebyo Vaishnava Ebyo Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. December 25th, 2015, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 8, Manifestation of Brahma from Garbhadaksha Vishnu, Text 25. Ayamito Vishtarata Swamana Dehena Loka Traya Sangrahena Vichitra Divya Baram Amsukanam Krita Shriya Pashrita Vesha Deham Ayamataha by length, Vishtarataha by breath, Swamana, by his own measurement, Dehena, by the transcendental body, Lokatraya, the three upper, middle, and lower planetary systems, Sagrahena, by total absorption, Vichitra, variegated, Divya, transcendental, Abharana Amshukanam, rays of the ornaments, Krita Shriya Apashrita, beauty created by those dresses and ornaments, Vesha, dressed, Deham, transcendental body. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. His transcendental body, unlimited in length and breadth, occupied the three planetary systems, upper, middle, and lower. His body was self-illuminated by unparalleled dress and variegatedness and was properly ornamented. Purport. The length and breadth of the transcendental body of the Supreme Personality of Godhead could only be measured by his own measurement because he is all-pervading throughout the complete cosmic manifestation. The beauty of material nature is due to his personal beauty, yet he is always magnificently dressed and ornamented to prove his transcendental variegatedness, which is so important to the advancement of spiritual knowledge. Ayamato vishtarataswamana dehena loka traya sangrahena vichitra divya bharana amshukanam krita shriya pashrita vesha deham. His transcendental body, unlimited in length and breadth, occupied the three planetary systems, upper, middle, and lower. His body was self-illuminated by unparalleled dress and variegatedness and was properly ornamented. Here Srila Prabhupada says that this transcendental variegatedness is so important in advancing spiritual knowledge. So here God's wearing dress and clothes, Vesha and Abharana. He's wearing clothing and ornaments. So such an idea may seem very strange. I was meditating once saying Prabhupada's pranam mantra at the beginning of this class. That for most of the world, to talk about God's clothing and ornaments, they can't relate because they think God doesn't have a form. Here we have deha meaning form, dehena, and deha. It's interesting, in the Bhagavad Gita, deha is never used to refer to the form of God, but only to the material bodies of the living entities. This particular case, it is referring to the form of the Lord as the creator of the universe. Not only does he have a form, the form has clothes on it, and the form has jewels on it. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary on this verse, says that this verse indicates the power of the Lord having whatever clothing he desires. So right now it's Christmas Day, and I'm sure that throughout the world, many people have been opening gifts last night and today that contained clothing and ornaments. We know a devotee who runs a jewelry store, and he said, "I can't talk to anybody till after Christmas." Why? Because so many people are buying jewelry, ornaments, as Christmas presents for others. And people are wearing, we're wearing clothing and ornaments. And we may wonder, well, okay, why does God wear clothing and ornaments? I mean, you know, just does that mean he has a body like us that he wants to dress and decorate? So we're going to look at why do we dress and decorate our own material bodies? Why do we wear clothes and jewels? And then why does God wear clothes and jewels? And what does he wear? So why do we wear clothes? Well, the main reason we wear clothes in most of the world is temperature control. Right, when you ask people, what are the greatest physiological needs of having a human body? Everybody says air first, and almost everybody says water next. Of course, we can live several days without water. Some people can live up to 7 or 10 days without water, depending on what's happening in the climate, etc. But what we can't live long without is proper temperature. So it doesn't take very much time. I mean, air, we're going to run out of air in 5 or 10 minutes. Proper temperature, we've got maybe 20 minutes, maybe an hour, depending on the extreme of the temperature. If it's way too hot, you know, we don't have much time at all, or way too cold. But we have a temperature regulating mechanism in our metabolism, which is why warm-blooded animals like us can live in a variety of climates, whereas, you know, the cold-blooded creatures have to stay in a semi-tropical climate. But our main function of clothing is temperature regulation, especially warmth. So the clothing traps the body heat, doesn't allow it to escape so fast, and forms a layer of heat around the body to keep us warm in cold climates. And of course, we also use clothing to keep us cool. The very loose, flowing, long, full covering clothing worn in very hot climates has basically an air circulation system built in. If you look at the long robes, long sleeves, full length robe-type garments of people in, say, the Middle East, where it gets even hotter than in most parts of India, as they walk, it forces air through the clothing. And the benefit of air, like we use a fan to cool us, or Krishna and his friends swing on swings to cool themselves in the summer. What it does is it takes the hot air and moves it away from the body more quickly. So we use clothing to either trap the heat that we're generating by our metabolism next to our body, or we use clothes as a way of moving that hot air away from our body. Of course, where we're getting the heat in our body is from the sun. The food that we digest through photosynthesis has trapped the sun. And when we metabolize it with the fire of digestion, which is also Krishna, we released that heat energy of the sun that keeps our bodies at a particular temperature. And our bodies can only function within a very small temperature range. I mean, here in Hawaii in December, it's funny that people from cold parts of the world come here for vacations. But for us in December, it's a little chilly in the morning, in the evening. I mean, it goes down to like 17 Celsius or something. And we all start getting on our warm clothing. So that's the primary reason that human beings wear clothing. And we see that people who live in very hot climates, primitive people, often don't wear clothing at all, or they wear very, very small amounts of clothing. And people who live in climates where they don't need clothing for warmth, they tend to wear clothing just to cover what we call the private parts, particularly the lower portions of their bodies. So that's the other reason that we wear clothing, right? The animals have natural clothing for temperature regulation. The animals that live in very cold climates, they have a thick layer of fat, a thick layer of fur, etc. But the animals never wear clothing for modesty purposes. Animals don't cover their reproductive or their elimination organs, and in fact they perform their elimination and reproductive acts in public. They don't have a sense of modesty about them, whereas human beings have not necessarily modesty about the elimination functions. I mean, for example, in India, people will evacuate and urinate in public, both men and women. But as far as the sexual function, most human societies, the sexual function is private. Of course, in modern Western society,
more and more the sexual function is becoming public. And it's quite an interesting thing when you go, when you've been brought up in the Western culture and you go to India, and Western culture, our elimination functions are very private and our sexual functions are becoming much more public. And in India, it's the reverse, where people don't engage in sexual behavior in public, but they will engage in elimination behavior in public. So it's quite interesting. But anyway, we wear clothing for modesty, some sense of shame or embarrassment, that there's something that's private and needs to be hidden from others. There's very, very few human cultures that engage in total nudity. It's very rare. Even the most primitive cultures, they tend to have some small piece of clothing that covers their reproductive organs. Which is interesting to think about, how sex desire is at so much of the root of our material life, and yet at the same time in human life, we have some sense that even in the most primitive societies, that there's something about it that's not good. Something about it that needs to be covered. So that's also why we wear clothing, but that's not the only reasons. The other reasons are to exhibit our status within a community. So you can often immediately tell the status of someone by how they're dressed. There's been a number of experiments, you know, where a person dresses in very shabby, torn, dirty clothing and collapses on a sidewalk, and the same person wears a business suit and collapses on the sidewalk. And when they're in shabby clothing, people just walk around them, and when they're in a business suit, people come to help them. So clothing very much indicates one's social status. And that's true in the form of the clothing, the color of the clothing, the cut of the clothing, the cleanliness of the clothing, the degree to which that clothing is presently in fashion. All of these things indicate our social status, are somewhere in the hierarchy, and all societies have some kind of status. I mean, there are some very simple primitive societies that have very limited status. I was reading yesterday some things about the Inuit primitive people who live in the far northern parts of Canada and America and Russia, you know, what we used to call the Eskimos when we were children. And they have basically no social system. They don't have towns and villages. And they just basically have family units that cooperate to some extent. So they don't have much of a status stratification system. And one of the difficulties with those people when they start integrating into modern society is to how to deal with the concept of social status. But the vast majority of human beings have some sort of status. Somebody who's higher than the other, a village chieftain at least, the elders in the village, you know, somebody who's higher than another. And almost always, says status is conveyed through clothing. Of course, in the modern day, our status, socioeconomic status, we call it. So, socioeconomic status is based on three things: your occupation, your level of education, and your degree of wealth. And definitely socioeconomic status is displayed in clothing. Of course, sometimes people very high in the socioeconomic status scale intentionally, like you think of someone like Steve Jobs or Mark Zuckerman, they intentionally wear very simple clothing as a sign of high status. They're saying, I'm such high status that I don't need to worry about the status marker anymore. You know, I've got such worldwide facial recognition that, and I'm such high status that I can abandon these sort of things. And we also have clothing which relates to what these people wear as a sense of identity. So clothing indicates our occupation to a large extent. What is our varna? You know, you go to a store like, you know, Home Depot in America, where you can buy lumber and nails and, you know, hardware to build things. And a lot of people there are wearing the clothes of manual laborers, because that's the kind of people who go there. So, you know, you see somebody wearing blue jeans. Blue jeans was originally the clothing of miners. It was made out of their tents, and it was put together with rivets. So, you know, you see people wearing dirty blue jeans, you assume that, oh, this is someone who engages in manual labor. And a lot of that occupation is told by your dress. There was one devotee, interestingly enough, who was complaining. She worked as a teacher, and she was complaining that the school, she worked in a government school in some part of the world, not in the first world. She was complaining that they wouldn't let her work there if she dyed her hair unnatural colors like purple and green. They said that doesn't fit with the dress code of a teacher. So also how we dress says something about our age. And when people are older, they tend to dress differently. People are teenagers, they tend to dress differently. We have certain clothes that we think are suitable for little children, other clothes that, you know, indicate, well, now I'm a teenager, something about age. It also tells something about whether or not we're married. We have here dress and ornaments. Srila Prabhupada would talk about how the woman's marital status could be seen by her dress. He said, you know, if she was married, her head was covered and she had sindoor powder in her hair. If she was unmarried, her head was uncovered. If she was a loose woman, a promiscuous woman, she parted her hair on the side. If her husband was dead, then she wore her hair loose and very simple clothing. In some parts of India, she would wear all white clothing. If her husband was away from home, she would be married, so she'd have her head covered with sindoor, but she would be wearing very simple clothing and fewer, no ornaments. And the injunction in the Shastra, in the seventh canto, is that a woman whose husband at home dresses herself very beautifully, gorgeous clothing and beautiful ornaments and so forth. And we have in the West, of course, we don't have that much detail, but we have the wedding ring. We don't have a sindoor in the part of the hair, but we have a wedding ring for both male and female persons that indicates your marital status, right? Of course, Vedic times also, we have the color of the cloth indicated something about ashram. Is somebody wearing saffron cloth? Are they wearing white cloth? And we have, of course, in our modern Gaudiya Vaishnava society, that saffron cloth worn in one way means you're in the brahmacharya, vanaprastha ashram, and worn another way shows that you're in the sannyasa ashram. So you immediately look at the person's cloth, and you can tell something about their identity. Right? Sometimes it's confusing. You're like, is that a brahmacharya? Is it a sannyasi? You know, is this person married or not married? So the clothing immediately gives us some clue as to how we deal with the person. You can say, well, why does it matter? Well, it's awkward to go to somebody and say, excuse me, are you married? But we relate differently to people depending on their identity. It changes our relationship with them. Clothing could also express one's political leanings or one's philosophy of life, what group you belong to, what religion you belong to. You know, we wear, as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we wear a certain kind of tilak. We wear a Gaudiya tilak. Of course, there's other branches of the Gaudiya Sampradaya who wear a different tilak. You know, the followers of Shamananda have a different kind of tilak. And then the other Sampradayas, you know, the Sri Sampradaya, they wear another kind of tilak. And the women and men each wear a different kind of tilak there. And the different branches of the Sri Sampradaya each wear a different kind of tilak. And this indicates, you know, okay, I'm a devotee of Vishnu. And then what school? Am I a follower of Ramanuja? Am I a follower of Madhva? Am I a follower of Sri Chaitanya? Am I a follower of in the Sarasvat school? And instantly, you can look and tell something about the person's affiliation. And that, this is true everywhere, right? All religious groups have some kind of demarcation, at least for the strict adherents. I mean, it's interesting that among the Mormons, what they do, and it's quite fascinating how they do this, they mandate a certain kind of undergarment, and the undergarment covers quite a bit of the body. So if you're wearing that under your clothes, you're forced to wear very modest clothes, otherwise your undergarments will show. So this is the Mormon dress. The Jews, the male Jews, wear an undergarment that has long fringes that stick out under their clothes. The men tend to wear a beard. In many religious societies, the married women, or sometimes all the mature women, cover their heads. You know, the Muslim women have the hijab, and they have various degrees of head covering with the hijab. And we just saw the other day, a Mennonite woman, she has a little transparent bonnet on her head. The Orthodox Jewish women either wear a scarf or, interestingly enough, a wig to cover their hair. So these all indicate identity, that these different kinds of dress, you know, you look at the person and you say, oh, you know, like when I saw the Mennonite couple at the farmer's market, I went up to them and I said, oh, yeah, nice to see some Mennonites here on the island. And a little while after that, somebody I didn't know came up to me and said, I just saw some Amish people. Are you one of them? I said, no, they're Mennonites, not Amish. So immediately just by looking at them, you get some sense of identity. But even non-religious identity, you know, there's a certain look of the New Age person. They're wearing jewelry made of crystals and so forth. And, you know, you can shop for different fashions that indicate I'm a conservative, I'm a liberal, you know, I'm a new age and all these kind of things. So these are the reasons why we dress in the way we do, for temperature control, for modesty, for status, and for identity. You know, identity immediately communicates to people relationship. So without having to ask us a lot of questions, without someone having to say, okay, who are you, what group are you in, you know, what do you believe in, they can just look at us and have some basic sense. You know, it's a little awkward to ask. But why does God wear clothes? You know, here we have God wears clothes. Well, why is he wearing clothes? Well, does God have to regulate his temperature? No, he doesn't. God doesn't have to regulate his temperature. He doesn't, although here he has a dehenan, a dehum. He has he's a form, but his form is without veins. He doesn't have some, you know, metabolism system getting light from the sun. He is the sun. He says, I am the sun, I am the moon, I supply heat, I am the fire of digestion. And he has his weapon, his Narayanajwara, his ultimate cold. So ultimate heat, ultimate cold within him, he is regulating everybody's temperature. Why does he need his temperature regulated? The Lord's form is not a machine. We're inside of a machine. But his form isn't a machine. His form is pure life. Well, does he have to wear clothes for modesty? Now, this is a very interesting question. And I don't think it's a question we can fully answer, but we can explore. So we find that the Lord also, he has a genital. He has an anus. These are described in the universal form. And Prabhupada was directly asked, does the Lord have a genital? He said, yes. In fact, it's such as described when Gargamuni is describing baby Krishna. He's describing the parts of his body that he has genitals. Yes, and the Lord's romantic, amorous encounters are the most glorious parts of his lila. They are the Adi Ras. I know, as Rishabhdev, when the Lord in his form as Rishabhdev was passing stool, that stool made the atmosphere fragrant for 80 miles around. The universal form, there's often descriptions of the semen of the Lord, that the, you know, the rivers of the semen of the Lord, and the rains which produce all the seeds, let all the seeds grow. So that's there. That's there. But we find that that the Lord also has garments that cover that portion of his form. And we also find, I was just thinking about this the other day because I was listening to and reading in the fourth canto where Lord Shiva is teaching the Purchetas a song, and of course later on here in the third canto we have something similar, where Lord Kapiladeva in the third canto, Lord Shiva in the fourth canto, and there's many other places, gives us a meditation on the form of the Lord. Our acharyas, you know, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has some books also like this, where the Lord's form is meditated on, and that portion is always skipped. So you meditate on the Lord's feet, you meditate on his calves, his knees, his thighs, sometimes his buttocks, in some descriptions, his back, his belly, you know, his chest, his shoulders, his arms, his hands, his neck, his chin, his cheeks, his nose, his ears, his eyes, his eyebrows, his forehead, his curling hair. But his genitals are never mentioned. So it seems that Krishna also has some sort of modesty. And in fact, his activities with the gopis are not for public display. Srila Prabhupada makes the point over and over again that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in his preaching did not discuss such activities of the Lord with the public. He did Harinam Sankirtan with philosophers such as Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. He discussed the Vedanta, and only with people like Ramananda Roy, Swarup Namadar, Sanatana Goswami, Rupa Goswami, did he discuss the Lord's activities with the gopis. And although many of the followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu describe some of these pastimes in great detail, right, Rupa Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur particularly, still those books were not meant for the general public. Right, Krishna Das Kaviraj with Govinda Lilamrita. when Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati asked his father, can I publish this book? And his father said, you can publish just one copy for yourself. So we want the books published. We don't want them to disappear. But they're not for general distribution or general discussion. Just like the Lord's wearing clothes. You know, he has some sense of modesty. And why is that? Is that because there's something wrong with it? You know, our own sexual behavior has something wrong with it. And what's wrong with it is that our sexual behavior, although we might like to say otherwise, is predicated primarily on our own pleasure. It is the using of someone else's most precious possession, their body, for our own enjoyment. Right? For our own enjoyment. And and one becomes, Ravindra Sri Prabhu wrote a very wonderful article in Back to Godhead about celibacy, and he said it's a total surrendering to the body. That sex is one totally surrenders one's consciousness to one's body in order to get pleasure from the body. Such doesn't generally happen with other kinds of sense gratificatory activities. So it's a total admission of being a slave to one's lust. And that's very embarrassing, to be a slave to anything. So right now we're working on Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha, and he compares lust, etc. He says, kam adi, you know, lust, anger, envy, greed, illusion, to highwaymen, highway robbers. Robbers that stop you when you're on the road. I don't think we have so many of these sort of bandits in most of the world today. I know in South Africa they do. People are terrified to stop at a traffic light, which they call a robot, because of the robbers that will steal their car and kill them. And Raghunath Das Goswami says these robbers on the road, by the way, is the shining path of bhakti, that they have very strong ropes. These ropes are composed of wicked deeds that they inspire, and they have us around the neck. And if you think about it, you know, if you have this greed personified, envy personified, lust personified, they have a rope in the shape of a noose, in the shape of a lasso, and it's around our neck. And they're dragging us around as somebody drags around an animal on a leash. So our lust is dragging us and forcing us to engage in activities to satisfy our lust. So that's very embarrassing. But for God, it's not like that. So why does God have some modesty about this? He doesn't, not that he has any kind of shame. And in fact, in one sense, they're all the residents of Vrindavan have some awareness. I was just reading in Gopal Champu, how when their residents are planning to go to Kurukshetra to meet Krishna and Balaram, it is said there by Jiva Goswami that Mother Yasoda has some knowledge of Krishna's relationships with the gopis, and she's very actually pleased by it, although she doesn't say it out loud, and Krishna never reveals to his mother his activities. So why is Krishna modest? Of course, Krishna's activities with his queens are very open, and he has so many children by his queens. It's part of the bliss of the Parakya Rasa. The Parakya Rasa is private and secret and mysterious, and that's part of what gives it its flavor. And just like Krishna as a little boy is stealing butter, well, why does he need to steal? All the butter belongs to him. And Mother Yasoda says that to him. She says, the butter's already yours. I'm going to use it for you. What is the point of your stealing it? Oh, but it's so much fun, right? It's so much fun to go and sneak something. So Krishna is enjoying this rasa. You know, there's some fear involved. Fear is one of the seven secondary rasas. Some fear. What's Krishna going to be afraid of? And Queen Kunti talks about this mystery. She says, fear personified runs away from you. Right? Shantim Gyam Richati. We get peace if we just meditate on Krishna. Just meditate on Krishna. Abhaya Charanada Vrindare. All the fear goes away. But Krishna is enjoying this fear. He's afraid of Mother Yasoda. He's actually feeling fear, really, truly feeling fear. He's feeling the real fear, the origin of all fear, the sweet fear. And he's afraid. He's afraid that, you know, the rival groups of gopis will find him with their rival. He's afraid that the elders will find him with the gopis. You know, he's enjoying this fear and this secretiveness and the mystery and the adventure. And therefore, it's somewhat private. And Krishna, of course, He has the greatest status, and his clothes also indicate his clothes and ornaments. He has certain clothes and ornaments that indicates that he and he alone is God. When Gopakumar goes to Vaikuntha, he keeps thinking that the devotees who have Swarupya are God. And he keeps saying, you know, Om Namo Narayanaya. And they're like, no, I'm just a servant. And finally they tell him, look, the Lord has certain distinguishing ornaments. He has the Kastuba jewel, which is said to be engraved like a calf, a pearl engraved like a calf, and the resting place of all living entities on the Lord's chest, and then he has the mark of Sri Vatsa on his chest. And he has these two distinct markings, one which is particularly an ornament. And this indicates his status as a supreme, that even those with Swarupi Mukti don't have this. And of course, Krishna does have clothes to show his identity. In Vraja, he wears cowherd boy clothes, and in Dwarka, he wears more princely clothes. Described again in Gopal Champu, when Balaram visits Vrindavan, he changes back into cowherd dress before entering Vrindavan. Gopakumar, how he's very careful to keep his cowherding dress, and sees the Lord like that. Mm-hmm. So the Lord's dress also indicates his relationships. He dresses to show his relationships, his rasa, with other living beings. It's the origin of why we dress. You know, you see Krishna dressed in this way. Oh, okay. And he dresses for different lilas. So he has clothes that he wears for bathing and swimming. He has clothes he wears for wrestling with the cowherd boys. He has clothes that he likes to wear to go out at night and meet the gopis. So he has the different clothes for different activities. Just like we have a different clothing if you're a college professor or you're a welder. And the Lord has different clothes for his Astakaliya lila. And not only do his clothes help his relationship with all of his devotees, but he has relationships with the clothes themselves, because everything in the spiritual world is alive. In Lalita Madhava Act 4, Scene 2, Text 50, Lalita is talking to Radharani, and she says, when you were having your personal pastimes with Krishna, it wouldn't be appropriate for a third person to be there, so did your belt, did your sash stay or did it go? Indicating that her belt is a person. And indeed, all of Krishna's clothes are alive. So there are living entities who want this relationship with the Lord as his clothes or his ornaments. So what does God wear? Generally, he wears yellow clothing, pitavas or pitambara. So pita, he's wearing yellow. Of course, we dress the deities in our temples in so many different colors of clothing. In fact, it's enjoined that one should dress the deities in certain colors according to the planetary deities of that day of the week. So Monday is the moon day, and the Lord will be dressed in white. Also, the acharyas explained that, at least in the evening, that Krishna and the gopis, on the full moon day, they will wear white clothes so as not to be detected, and on the dark moon day, they will wear dark clothes. Then on Tuesday, which is the day of Mars, the Mardi day, so there we dress the Lord in things like orange and red, and on Wednesday, Mercury's day, mostly in green. On Thursdays, the day of Jupiter, mostly in yellow. On Friday, the day of Sukracharya, pink or white. And then on Saturday, the day of Saturn, dark colors, black and so forth. Sunday, which is the day of the sun, red or any color, because the sun contains all colors. So there's lists of the colors that we dress the deities in by the days of the week. So we don't only dress the deities in yellow. And I know Pushkar Prabhu, our artist, he would complain. He said, in our paintings, we always have to put Krishna in yellow, but on the altar, we can dress him in so many colors. You know, it must be frustrating for an artist that I can only use one color. And we were having some paintings done for Manashiksha. So we have one painting of Rasalila where Krishna is with the eight principal gopis. And so I was asking the artist to please have the gopis dress the way the acharyas describe them. You know, like Lalita's wearing clothes the color of peacock feather, Vishaka's wearing stars, and Radharani's wearing a pink blouse and a blue clothing and so forth. So the artist was complaining, and he said, you know, well, I'm sure they don't always wear these clothes. And I said, no, certainly they don't always wear those clothes. I have a good friend who's been a pujari for many, many years, and she was telling me, head pujari, how one night she had a dream that she was in the pujari room and the deity was manifest there. And he was taking her on a tour around the pujari room and saying, I really like this outfit and I really like this jewelry and I especially like it when I wear this jewelry with this outfit, but I don't like this jewelry. That was a very interesting dream. And then in her dream, someone else entered the pujari room and the deity quickly ran out of the room and jumped back on the altar and stood still. So certainly Krishna has his favorite things to wear. I mean, so do we. My friend Lakshmi Moni, whose husband took sannyas a long time ago and has been wearing only white for decades, she said to me, you know, people think that all my clothes look the same, but I still have my favorites. I mean, I do know some people who really and truly have all their clothes exactly the same. They just get, you know, duplicates and duplicate pieces of cloth. But she was saying, you know, I have my favorites. And most of us have our favorite clothing, right? We have the sari we really like, or the dhoti we really like, or the shoes we really like. So Krishna has his favorite clothing, and he particularly likes his flowing yellow cloth. Sometimes it's described as saffron color rather than yellow color. And he's described as having four pieces of clothing by Rupa Goswami. He's got a shirt, a chadar, a lower garment, and a belt. And of course, sometimes he leaves his chadar here and there, and it has to be retrieved. But certainly he has a variety of clothes, and although he always wears his kastuba jewel, he certainly has a variety of ornaments that he wears at different times, seasons. Krishna has six seasonal forests in the spiritual world through the different seasonal forests. Like it says, they don't wear pearls in the winter forest because pearls are cooling at different times of the day and so forth. And Krishna especially likes makara-shaped earrings. So our artist just, in one of his last paintings, he put dolphin-shaped earrings. And I said, well, they're not really dolphins. I mean, Prabhupada translates the word makara as dolphin or shark, but it really is a makara because there's no English translation for makara. Makara is some conglomerate creature that we don't see on the earth, and it's the carrier of Cupid. So Krishna loves these makara earrings. I'm sure, again, that he has many different sets of earrings. I mean, an ordinary woman in the world, of course, men sometimes wear earrings too, but an ordinary woman in the world doesn't just have one set of earrings. So Krishna has many sets of earrings. Maybe he has many sets of makara earrings. But he also has his favorite, and the makara, Krishna's Cupid's carrier, and it's said, I think in Vrajavilastava, I believe, that the earrings are swinging to and fro, and therefore they are the best of his ornaments because they are kissing his cheeks. They are the only ones of his ornaments that are kissing his cheeks, and they are teaching his eyes to dance. So this is what God wears. And of course, God also likes to wear, in addition to ornaments of living, and these are all alive, not only are Krishna's clothes alive, his ornaments are alive, and these are living jewels. And the C.S. Lewis wrote this famous Narnia books, which are supposed to be religious analogies, and we had them in our Gurukul library. And in one of them, which one? The Silver Chair, I think. So he talks about these children who go down deep into the earth. And deep into the earth, of course, there's the jewel mines. And then they see there's an even deeper place, and they're told that there the jewels are alive. They said, the jewels that you mine in this earth are dead. But here we have living jewels. So Krishna has living jewels. His jewels are alive. They are persons. And he ornaments them. Krishna ornaments his jewels and his clothing. You know, most of us in this world, I mean, unless you have extremely good karma, most of us look a lot better with clothes and jewelry on, right? Perhaps another reason we didn't mention that we wear clothing is to disguise our bodily flaws. So people wear clothing that, you know, make one thing smaller or another part bigger, or squeeze this part into this shape and push that part over there, and right? And our bodies are not very, for most of us, again, some people may have very attractive bodies, but for most of us, our bodies are not very attractive. Even if they were attractive when we were 16, they don't usually stay that way. So we also wear clothes to disguise the ugliness of our bodies and to make us appear more attractive than we really are. Right? The same with jewelry. People wear jewelry to make their bodies appear more attractive. And, of course, in the modern day, just women, some men wear makeup, but generally just women paint their faces to make them look more attractive. And Krishna and the cowherd boys, also Krishna and the gopis, they also paint their faces and their bodies. But they're doing it for fun. And they make that more attractive. So Krishna makes his face painting more attractive. Krishna makes his jewelry more attractive. Krishna makes his clothes more attractive. Not that they make him more attractive. Krishna makes them more attractive. So Prabhupada says that this, he's always magnificently dressed and ornamented to prove his transcendental variegatedness, which is so important, and the advancement of spiritual knowledge. So spiritual knowledge, well, spiritual knowledge, it sounds very Brahman, doesn't it? The spiritual knowledge. But if you really want spiritual knowledge, one has to go to Bhagavan. And when one goes to Bhagavan, one finds this variegatedness, transcendental variegatedness. Clothing and ornaments, designs, and as we mentioned briefly, even drawing of designs on their form. Smearing perfumes on their form, although Krishna is the source of all perfumes. He's the source. He says, "I'm the fragrance." So why is this important for our advancement of spiritual knowledge? So important, Prabhupada said, because it's part of our relationship and part of our service. One of the main services for the devotees, particularly for the neophyte devotee, but also done by the Uttam Bhaktas, done by Rupa Goswami, done by Gopal Bhatta Goswami. Gopal Bhatta Goswami was lamenting, "I only have a Shalagram Shila, I can't dress him." And the next morning there was Radharaman. So even the Uttam Bhaktas, they aspire to dress and ornament the deity. And for the neophyte, it's very important. Prabhupada says, when we see the beauty of the deity in the temple, we become detached from worldly beauty. And when we dress and ornament the deity, we become detached from dressing and ornamenting our own form. And we have this, we get into a relationship with Krishna. What clothing would you like to wear today? What ornaments would you like to wear today? How can I decorate you? In many temples, the deities are elaborately painted with various designs. Right? And there's a whole industry, but a whole service department among the devotees of making the dresses from the Lord. You know, I know in the New York temple they have top New York dress designers design Radha Govinda's clothing. And intricate embroidery, and it'd be service. And service. I love in New Mayapur in France, the Krishna and Balaram and Radha Krishna Gaunitai, they have clothing for the season, so they have a fall and a winter and a spring and a summer outfit that's decorated with the birds and flowers of that season. And it really looks, when the deities are wearing those clothes, it looks like they're in the spiritual world walking through that seasonal forest, and the just like when the Lord walks through the seasonal forest with the gopis or with the cowherd boys. They stop and they take parts of the forest and they use them to decorate their body. They use parts of the flowers and the fruits and the mineral dyes to decorate their body. So we can do that with the deity. Even if we're gross neophytes, even if we're very materialistic and all we see is earth, water, fire, air, and ether, still we can decorate and dress the Lord in his deities, in his deity form. And also the Lord's dress and ornaments can inspire us as udipans, as stimulus for our relationship with the Lord. We want each devotee sees the Lord's form a little differently because each devotee has a different relationship. Each devotee sees the Lord dressed a little differently depending on their particular relationship, depending on how they want to see the Lord. Of course, as a side note, which I don't want to get into very much because it is so controversial, how we dress our bodies is also part of our service. How we dress our own bodies is also part of our service. Just like people in the world, they use their dress for these various purposes, so do we. So we need to dress our body, of course, for temperature and for modesty. As devotees of the Lord, we should be particularly concerned with modesty, right? Because we're trying to become detached from sexual lust. So we especially want to have modest clothing. And we also want to have clothing that, at the very least, Prabhupada would say, indicates that we're a lady or a gentleman. We want to have clothes that say to the world, I'm a higher class person. Such was very important. Just like Prabhupada said, he didn't want his male disciples having beards or long hair because it would be associated with hippies. I mean, traditionally, Vaishnavas, we see that they would have a beard, especially during Chaturmasya and so forth. Many of the yogis have beards and long hair. But Srila Prabhupada didn't want someone to look at us and say, oh, there's a hippie. Just like Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wanted Sanatana Goswami to shave and not be associated with the Muslims. So we do want to portray a certain identity. Like Prabhupada said, the police officer is immediately recognized. We want the way that we dress and ornament and decorate our own bodies to be such that also gives glory to the Lord. Does that mean we have to have some kind of standardized uniform? I think that's a little ridiculous. But the question is, that do we want to dress our bodies in a way that is also service, not only dressing the Lord's body, but dressing our bodies? This is our wonderful philosophy. Who talks about God's dress and clothing, dress and ornaments? I mean, maybe a little bit in the West, they might have some idea of God wearing kind of flowing, glowing robes. But the detail that we have in our Gaudiya Siddhanta that Srila Prabhupada has brought to us, and how we can meditate on the Lord's clothing and ornaments and decoration as a way of expressing love is really beyond compare. We are most fortunate, we are most grateful to Srila Prabhupada, to A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, that he has brought us this treasure to those of us who knew nothing. And even in India, frankly, most Indians knew nothing. They had their philosophy, but it was just their religion and their rituals without understanding. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So anybody have any questions or comments?
Comment, and then I had a question just regarding our clothing indicating status. You gave so many great examples. A couple that popped into my mind was we have blue-collar worker, white-collar workers, which is so much indicating their status. And I was thinking, I'm a member of Kaiser Permanente. I noticed that all the specialists that you go to are always wearing white coats. Mm. But the general practitioners, the family doctors, they're allowed to wear regular clothes, aloha shirts, slacks. And so that was making me think that what we wear makes others, puts them in a certain mood. I think that, you know, perhaps I'm speculating now that they don't mind or I guess they encourage or perhaps mandate that the general practitioners to dress casually so that you feel much more relaxed and open to talk and so on, but very, very serious when you're with, you know, some doctor that's wearing white coats.
There's a book I read years ago. I forget the name of it. But it was about how medicine has become a modern church and the doctors have become the priests. And the medicines are the sacraments, and that people just follow the doctors and do whatever they say. But those sort of indicators of clothing, oh, here's somebody with a white lab coat, and we immediately become submissive. Whatever they say must be true. I mean, I think it's amazing that if somebody has cancer, for example, they go to a doctor, and the doctor says, we're going to pump you full of poisons, and the person says, sure. You know, and a lot of that is on their authority. So what was your question?
My question was, you were giving the example of your friend that had the dream that the deity appeared before them and was indicating what jewelry they like and what they don't like. So how seriously do we take something like that? That isn't the kind of thing you can really judge with regard to, you know, Shastra, Sadhu, and Guru. I mean, unless, of course, it was something, you know, they told her, put on something totally outrageous. Well, that would be, of course, negated by Shastra Sadhu Guru. But in terms of their preference, how seriously do we take something like that?
I think that's a personal thing. We have a lot of Shastra Guru precedent for the Lord speaking to devotees in dreams.
And Prabhupada said, if we dream of Krishna, the spiritual master, that's very nice. But like everything else, it has to be within the circle of Sadhu Shastra Guru. So that's the criteria, and your dream may not be authoritative for me. No. I mean, it's just like even my own personal realizations may not be authoritative for you.
That's a nice point.
That such is even true among the different branches of the Sampradaya, and this is something I've thought about a lot as ISKCON has matured over the years and we've gotten so many sister organizations. And that is that, just for example, in ISKCON, we don't usually or practically ever, we don't quote from a lot of Srila Prabhupada's godbrothers or the disciples of Prabhupada's godbrothers. We just don't. In fact, most people in ISKCON are not even aware of the names of those people. You know, we know a few. People in ISKCON know the names of a few prominent godbrothers of Srila Prabhupada, but not most of them. And what to speak of their disciples, and most people in ISKCON don't read their books. They don't celebrate their appearance and disappearance day. Although they're in our Sampradaya, they're, you know, uncles and cousins and like that. We don't necessarily take them as authorities at all. Whereas people in other parts of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, coming from Bhakti Siddhanta, I mean, we're talking about our intimate connection, they will. You know, there's devotees here on this island of Hawaii who have big celebrations for the appearance and disappearance day of people in other, you know, branches of the Gaudiya Sampradaya that is only celebrated, you know, in those branches. And then you have even within ISKCON. So within ISKCON, you have so many different gurus, and you're going to have, you know, some people will, and many of these gurus have written books. And in these books, they will have, not only are they quoting Sadhu Shastra Guru, but they're also giving their own realization. And the realization from that one guru may not be accepted by the disciples of other gurus, even though they're all within ISKCON. Now, it's the way it is. So if that's true even for a guru, you know, just because so-and-so Swami is your guru, and he's had such and such realization, if he's not my guru, even though he's in our family, he's in our school, I may not accept his realization as authoritative. So, you know, we were followers of Srila Prabhupada. We accept, practically speaking, I would say, Srila Prabhupada's purports as having the same level of authority as the verses. Maybe not absolutely 100%, but pretty close. We accept Rupa Goswami's words as having the same authority as the Shastric texts. You know, I mean, if there's a difference, it's a pretty small difference. But somebody else wouldn't. So someone else in the Gaudiya Mat, I mean, there's members of the Gaudiya Mat that aren't connected with A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada at all. They're not going to take his own realizations as authoritative like that. They're just not. What to speak of if you go to someone in the Madhva Sampradaya or the Sri Sampradaya, you know, they won't even have heard of most of our acharyas, like we won't have heard of most of theirs. You know, we don't even know the names of their acharyas. I don't know the names of all the acharyas in the Madhva Sampradaya. I haven't read their books. And if I do, I would take them through Srila Prabhupada. I don't take Srila Prabhupada through them, which is, by the way, an interesting phenomena that I see, that, you know, devotees will say, well, I understand Prabhupada through the previous acharyas rather than understanding the previous acharyas through Prabhupada. And how do you do that? You started with Prabhupada, how do you then do it the other way? So what to speak of on a personal level, you know, somebody like me who's an absolute nobody. So, you know, my dreams and my realizations, they may have meaning for me. I mean, there was a few years ago, I was really praying to Srila Prabhupada about a particular service that was difficult for me. I didn't know if I should do the service or not. I mean, I was getting a lot of conflicting feedback from other devotees, and it was a very, very difficult service with a lot of responsibility. And I asked Srila Prabhupada, you know, please give me some indication that will be completely clear, at least to me, where I will know for sure what you want me to do. And he did.
But I realized it wasn't the kind of evidence that other people might accept. You know, if I went to someone else and I said, well, this is what happened to me, and this is, you know, this is what convinced me of what I should do in this situation, they might say, well, that wouldn't convince me. So that's, you know, and you can't always express even what happened, but how you felt, what were the circumstances, you know. And I've learned over the years that generally not to share such things, because they don't have the same meaning for other people as they have for myself. Or if I share them, to share them very guardedly. So I think that that's sort of true across the board. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's very helpful. And yeah, that takes it a lot further than I was asking, because if we apply what you just said to others, when something has meaning and authority to them, then we really have to respect that.
As long as it's within
the... reasonable, that's... Yeah,
as long as it's within the realm of Sadhu Shastra Guru.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if someone says, you know, well, I have some realization that Lord Nrisingadev dances with gopis, then you say, I'm sorry, that's not within the realm of Sadhu Shastra Gurus. You know, if there's no mention of such things anywhere, so it's wrong. And if you've had that so-called realization, then it's not bona fide. You know, it's got to be within that range. It can't be full of rasa-basa. So we find, you know, like Swarup Damodar was the main gatekeeper to make sure that nothing that came to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had rasa-basa. You know, that one devotee wrote this book, and he said, Lord Chaitanya is the moving Jagannath, and Lord Jagannath is the non-moving God. But and then the devotee said, oh, this is wonderful, this is wonderful. And then Swarup Damodar was a little careful. And he said, what exactly do you mean by this? What's your intention? What's your meaning behind your words? And then the devotee explained that he saw the deity form of Jagannath as having a material body, and immediately Swarup Damodar said, this is not proper. You've had this realization, but it's not proper. So each of us also as individuals, we need to have, you know, we emphasize this, oh, we have to have a guru, we have to have gurus, we have to have sadhus we go to, and we can go... If we have some understanding or some dream or some whatever that is not absolutely, totally clear that it's within the circle of Sadhu Shastra Guru, then we have to consult. And we have to say, well, you know, I've had this understanding, I've had this experience, and even the one experience I was alluding to, there was somebody that I talked to about it. You know, I went to one of my senior god sisters and I said, you know, I was praying for this, and I was praying for years for some clarity on this point, and this is what happened, and everything became completely crystal clear, but what do you think? And she said, yes, that definitely is the answer to your question. So as, you know, as she's someone who's very senior to me, and somebody who's, she's practically speaking, memorize the meaning of every single verse of the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam. She's one of the greatest scholars of the Shastra, very austere and devoted sadhaka, totally pukka in her prachar and achar. So then I took, okay, that she's confirming, then that's okay. So we need that too, you know. It shouldn't just be, I think it's within guru, sadhu, and Shastra. I mean, I know of an instance, I don't want to talk about the details at all, and please don't ask me because I just won't. But I know of an instance of someone who left Krishna consciousness and formed his own society, made about 10, 15 disciples, and he came up with he had had some personal realization, which according to Sadhu Shastra Guru would be very rasa-basa. But he decided that that was the truth, and he was going to preach the truth, and he based it on some sort of experience he had, plus he based it on a one phrase in one verse of the Bhagavatam. And although people told him it was bogus, he never changed his stance, and eventually he left Krishna consciousness completely and became a Buddhist. So one should be very careful that even if we think we can justify something, you know, we find three words in the Shastra that justifies our realization, we definitely need to consult. Again, we may not convince everybody. That's what it is. But at least we have to be very certain that we don't take just our own realizations as absolute on our own.
Nice answer. Thank you.
Ramananda, do you want to say something?
Now that others have gone once, twice, thrice. Okay, I was going to say, I don't know what others thought, but I thought that your analysis of clothing was phenomenal. It was like, geez, did you do a PhD on this? Is this like a thesis? That was amazing how you went into it. Anyway, I just want to express my appreciation. I've never heard such a thing. That was really, really nice. If you don't mind, I have a question on a verse that we just covered a few days ago that you didn't give a class on. I know you don't like doing this, but we're going to move off of it. If you don't mind, it's just verse 20.
Even Prabhupada didn't like that. He'd say you should ask questions relevant to the class. He said, otherwise everything goes on over and over and over again. But on and on and on. Okay, so verse 20, where it says, Overdure, while searching in that way about his existence, Brahma reaches ultimate time, which is the eternal wheel in the hand of Vishnu, which generates fear in the mind of a living entity like the fear of death. That one?
Yes. Okay. So his ultimate time, I didn't exactly understand what that meant. Madan Mohan gave a nice explanation that devotees realize they have a limited amount of time, they're controlled by time, and then it's something other people don't think about, etc. And I thought that was nice, but if you think about it, Brahma, at this point, he has no reference to time, because the only way you can perceive time is through change or through motion. But there was nothing in the universe at that time. So what, in your opinion, is this referring to? Or how is that possible for him to even perceive?
Okay, well, as soon as you start talking about perceiving time, you're in trouble. And there's two articles written in Back to Godhead by our God brother Maturesh about time. I would refer you to them. Time is basically, yes, it's imperceptible except through change or the movement of one object in relationship to another object. Otherwise, time is imperceivable by our senses completely. Now, we could safely assume here that Brahma, having a material body, did have some change. So you're saying there's no movements of one object in relationship to another at this point in creation, which I believe is correct. I believe that at this point in creation, there's not a sun moving to demarcate time. But his body would be changing. And Brahma being, I can perceive the changes in my body, not on a minute-to-minute basis, but I can perceive the changes in my body which indicate the passing of time. Why would Brahma not be able to do so? Is that all right? Anybody else? We could take one more.
Just a minor question.
Should first ask if someone else has anything.
Okay.
If that's okay. Anybody else who hasn't said anything have a question? Anybody at all? Okay, go ahead.
Well, you had mentioned Ravindra Sarup had written an article on celibacy.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of Ravindra Sarup and his writings, and I really love the subject of celibacy. Where is that article? I'd love to read it.
It's in Back to Godhead, and actually I'm not sure which. He has two articles at least on sex. One is called Immortal Longings, and the other is called Celibacy, Exquisite Torture, or a Yes to God. And actually, I don't remember whether what I referred to was in the celibacy article or the Immortal Longings article. But he has those are two articles that he wrote on sexual desire, both of which appeared in Back to Godhead. They should both be in the Veda base. If you can't find them there, they will be on the Krishna.com site under Back to Godheads if you search by author. So again, that's what they're called. One of them is called Immortal Longings, and the other is called Celibacy, Exquisite Torture, or a Yes to God. Okay, I'm willing to go on another 3 minutes if anyone else has anything else. No? All glories to the clothing and ornaments of the Lord. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.